Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonzo reporting. U.S. and Somali forces have attacked an al-Shabaab base west of Mogadishu. It's a second significant U.S. attack on the militant group in 5 days. A U.S. official confirmed to VOA that the raid Wednesday was a joint U.S.-Somali government operation targeting al-Shabaab. A local official in Somalia said helicopters dropped between 60 to 70 soldiers outside the town just after midnight. The official told VOA the troops then attacked 3 or 4 targets in the town, inflicting a number of casualties on the militants. Al-Shabaab says one of its fighters was killed in the raid. You can read more details on that story at voanews.com. U.S. Vice President Joe Biden Wednesday condemned a string of attacks by Palestinians that came as he visited Israel, saying there could be no justification of the hateful violence. Speaking alongside Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Biden called Tuesday's deadly stabbing of an American a heinous terrorist act. He said civilized leaders cannot see the violence as appropriate behavior. Netanyahu said nothing justifies the attacks and criticized Palestinian leaders for not condemning them.
President Abbas has not only refused to condemn these terrorist attacks, his Fatah party actually praised the murderer of this American citizen as a Palestinian martyr and a hero. Now, this is wrong. And this failure to condemn terrorism, it should be condemned itself.
UN Syria envoy Stephane de Mistura was in Geneva Wednesday, ready to resume peace talks with Syria's warring side. But the delegations are still expected to arrive over the next few days, and the process will be a slow start. The UN attributed the delays to logistical arrangements. VOA News. Iran says it launched 2 ballistic test missiles Wednesday, purportedly inscribing them with a message in Hebrew that says Israel should be wiped from the pages of history. The semi-official Fars news agency showed pictures it said were of Qadr H missiles being fired from Iran's eastern Alborz mountain range, their target 1,400 kilometers away off the country's coast into the Sea of Oman. The reason we designed our missiles with the range of 2,000 kilometers is to be able to hit our enemy. That's according to Brigadier General Amir Ali Hazadeh of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Members of France's General Confederation of Labor marched through the streets of Paris Wednesday, demanding French President François Hollande abandon plans to tamper with the country's 35-hour work week to create new jobs. Angry union and youth joined forces in a day of protests against those proposed changes. This is the Secretary General of the Workers' Force Union. He says, we have entered into a fight with the government to demand that it withdraw its draft labor law. Several union and student organizations called the protests across France on Wednesday to try to kill the bill. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un said Wednesday that the country has developed miniature nuclear warheads that can fit on a ballistic missile. However, while such claims are not new, what is new is that this is the first time the North Korean leader has made such an assertion. Brian Myers is the associate professor of international studies at Dongseo University in South Korea.
North Korea is, I think, quite frustrated by the West's persistence in regarding it as a communist state, because that misperception leads the West to assume that North Korea is not that much of a threat. You know, the communists had nuclear weapons for decades and never used them. And this is why even now, Washington seems to think the worst case scenario is that the North Koreans are going to sell atomic material to terrorists. So this rhetoric is the North's way of saying to Washington, you guys better keep us on the front burner because we are just as ready to fight and die as your enemies in the Middle East are.
Former Beatles drummer Ringo Starr has announced the death of the so-called fifth Beatle, producer Sir George Martin, at the age of 90. Starr posted the news on Twitter Wednesday with a photograph of Martin with the Beatles, captioned, "Thank you for all your love and kindness, George." Universal Music Group has confirmed the death, but details have not been released. British Prime Minister David Cameron tweeted a tribute early Wednesday, calling Martin a giant of music. More at voanews.com. I'm Frances Alonzo in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yais Wuhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
I would like to emphasize that it is very important for the country to gain clarity about the human rights violations that have taken place since the crisis started.
That's UN human rights investigator Pablo de Grief commenting on the situation in Burundi following an eight-day visit. Details coming up.
Also, dozens of Ethiopian university students protested last night against recent police crackdowns in Addis Ababa. And in Nigeria, labor unions are protesting government plans to restructure the state-run oil industry.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny. Music from DRC and our daily feature, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour: in Kenya, militant groups such as Al-Shabaab and the Islamic State continue to lure young Muslims to fight back. A local organization has launched a de-radicalization program to train imams and work with the affected youth. Lenny Ruvaga has the story from Pwani, outside the capital, Nairobi.
In Somalia, terrorists are killing Muslims. In Kenya, they seek to kill non-Muslims to create animosity between faiths.
Jihad, as we have seen in this clip, does not mean only, fighting.
Ramadan Aulo takes to radicalized young men through a session. Today, the module is on counter-narratives. Aulo is the program manager at BRAVE, short for Building Resilience Against Violent Extremism. Today's session has two participants who willingly signed up for the de-radicalization sessions. The program has reached 2,000 young people. For those trying to counter the message of radicals, such as clerics and imams, or youth not affiliated with a terror group, the program offers four-day training modules. For radicalized youth, those who have joined a militant group like Al-Shabaab, the program takes anywhere from 6 months to 3 years. In 2013, a United Nations report linked one of those officials at Riyadh Mosque in Pumwani to terrorist funding. Imam Izzedine Omar has been at the mosque for 5 years, and the BRAVE program trained him how to detect and counter extremist leanings in his community. Imam Omar says that before the radicalized youth accept to be de-radicalized, it takes a while and they have to go step by step. But eventually they succeed, even for those who are deeply rooted in radicalization. Abdul Mwangi is one of those youth who attended sermons in other mosques where radical preachers called on people to devote their lives to jihad. He shied away from that line of thought after going through the BRAVE program.
We were able to be told about the issue of the narratives. At least after there, alhamdulillah, what I can say, like for myself and my other youth, even if you tell me something that Quran says, yes, I will accept, but I will not do anything doing implementation before I go back to the Quran and confirm for myself, or else I go to the Hadith or any other books that you might have been quoted.
BRAVE has trained about 150 clerics and imams like Omar, but the founder of the program says some are still staying away due to fear of reprisal.
Many Kenyans, particularly the Muslims, have been intimidated by the violent extremist groups to such an extent that they don't want to talk about violent extremism. They don't want to talk about terrorism. Now, this intimidation is so intense in places like Mandera in northeastern Kenya.
De-radicalization programs are not new. Saudi Arabia has run one since 2004. Both Nigeria and Mauritania have them. But there is a lot of debate as to whether they actually work. Experts like security analyst Andrew Franklin say root causes like unemployment must also be addressed.
De-radicalization programs are dealing with symptoms rather than causes of the problem. The real question is simply what causes people, youth, particularly, to move from being alienated, marginalized, and the like, to picking up weapons. In other words, becoming radicalized, to going off and to fight, to join terrorist groups or subversive groups, insurgent groups.
As prisons across Africa fill up with terrorist suspects, that is a question the continent cannot afford to dismiss. Lenny Rovaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Dozens of Ethiopian university students protested last night against recent police crackdowns in Addis Ababa. Reuters says demonstrators claim authorities have detained and beaten students during earlier demonstrations. The protests began in November over government plans to take over farmlands near the capital for urban development. Authorities scrapped the land reforms in January, but sporadic demonstrations have persisted. Ethiopian Prime Minister Hailemariam Desalegn has promised to address grievances in the Oromia region that surrounds the capital. Mr. Desalegn blames rebel groups for stoking violence. New York-based Human Rights Watch said last month that some demonstrators were subjected to severe beatings and never appeared before a judge. Ethiopian authorities have dismissed the report. Rights groups and U.S.-based dissidents say as many as 200 people may have been killed in the capital city protests.
Police in Bujumbura have arrested one of the last opposition leaders remaining in troubled Burundi. According to the French news agency, family and supporters say 47-year-old Hugo Harimata Gekko, the president of the New Alliance for the Development of Burundi, was arrested at his home in the capital, Bujumbura, in a dawn raid today. Police were not available for comment or to describe any charges.
The United Nations Independent Investigation Team on Burundi says there are strong signs of human rights violations by both the government and the opposition since last April, when protests against the incumbent president run for a controversial third term started. Moses Javier Amina reports from Bujumbura.
United Nations independent experts spent 8 days in Burundi in the first phase of their investigation. They met, interviewed, and exchanged information with a wide range of actors that included the government, opposition leaders, civil society organizations, and victims of human rights violation. Mr. Pablo de Grief, who was part of the mission, said that the government officials were very open to engage. However, he says some individuals felt intimidated.
I would like to emphasize that it is very important for the country to gain clarity about the human rights violations that have taken place since the crisis started. So in addition to the fact that the victims have a right to truth, justice, reparation, and guarantees of non-recurrence, there is some danger involved in letting the issue of human rights undecided.
The United Nations Human Rights Council met last December and adopted the resolution to set up a mission to Burundi to look on ongoing and in recent past violations in the country. Since April last year, the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights reported well over 400 killings, more than 260 arbitrary arrests, and over 260 cases of torture or ill treatment. Christoph Haynes is the United Nations Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial, summary, or arbitrary executions.
That the future of Burundi, internally in the country itself, but internationally, will depend on its performance in human rights. Human rights will be central to the future of Burundi. There are strong allegations of torture that takes place, of disappearances as well, and I think it will be crucial to address the situation and in a way to prevent future violations as well, to have ways of verifying the truth on the ground.
In the provisional report, the United Nations mission said that it is very important for Burundi to not only gain some understanding of the recent violations, but also address problems of impunity concerning violations that took place in the past. The second phase of the mission will include human rights observers. It is expected to be deployed later this year, with the final report expected in September. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
The UN Special Investigator on Torture finds lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people are at particular risk of torture and ill treatment, especially in places of detention. Lisa Schlein reports from the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva, where the investigator has submitted his report.
Fears are growing that the rising ethnic divide in Burundi is beginning to resemble the situation that preceded Rwanda's 1994 genocide, which killed some 800,000 people, mainly Tutsis, by Hutus. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Zeid Raad al-Hussein, is clearly worried about emerging new trends in Burundi, including cases of sexual violence by security forces and a sharp increase in forced disappearances. He warns that attacks by opposition groups against three military bases in the capital, Bujumbura, on December 11th and 12th triggered large-scale human rights violations by the government. The High Commissioner's spokesman, Rupert Colville, says the UN has documented 13 cases of sexual violence against women during search and arrest operations following the December events. He says new cases of sexual violence are continuing to emerge. He notes victims of these operations say they were targeted because they were Tutsis.
The suggestion that an ethnic dimension is now starting to emerge is reinforced by one of the sexually abused women who said that her abuser told her she was paying the price for being a Tutsi. Another witness claimed that Tutsis were systematically killed while Hutus were spared.
Colville says the UN Human Rights Office also has received numerous allegations that many young men were picked up by police and army forces during this search operation. He says many were later tortured, killed, or taken to unknown destinations. He says the High Commissioner is particularly alarmed at the increasing number of disappearances, coupled with allegations of secret detention facilities and mass graves.
Witnesses have reported the existence of at least 9 mass graves in Bujumbura and its surroundings, including one in a military camp. And together, they're believed to contain more than 100 bodies in total, all of them allegedly killed on the 11th of December.
High Commissioner Zaid is calling for an urgent, impartial investigation into the events on December 11th and 12th, including the alleged mass graves. He says it is critical for these grave sites to be safeguarded. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Nigeria, labor unions today announced the national shutdown of Nigeria's state oil operations. They're protesting government plans to restructure the state-run industry. The French news agency quotes a spokesman for the Petroleum and Natural Gas Senior Staff Association as saying the move could worsen local fuel supplies. The government plans would break up the state oil and gas agency into 30 companies with individual managing directors.
Tunisian authorities say they've killed 2 more terrorists in another clash in the town of Ben Guerdain near the Libyan border. AFP reports that brings the number of suspected Islamic State fighters killed in recent days to 45. Authorities say the militants were killed when they tried to break into a building to steal food. In related news, Italy's foreign minister says Islamic State has 5,000 fighters in Libya. He says the group has the ability to launch raids into neighboring countries. Italy, the U.S., Britain, and France reportedly are conducting reconnaissance and intelligence operations in Libya. Also, AFP reports Italy has given the U.S. permission to use an airbase in Sicily to launch drone strikes in Libya.
Meanwhile, the head of the UN support mission in Libya says the Islamic State group is taking advantage of the political and security vacuum in Libya. Martin Kobler told the UN Security Council that Islamic State is expanding in nearly all directions. Our senior Middle East reporter Mohammed El-Shanawi explored different perspectives on countering the terrorist group in Libya.
Rival Libyan governments are still unable to agree on a unity government.
The UN is reconvening a meeting this week to explore the way forward in line with the Libyan political agreement, which is crucial to start the campaign to uproot Islamic State from Libya. The UN deal calls for a presidential council to lead a unified government, with the current eastern-based House of Representatives as the main legislature and a state council as a second consultative chamber. The presidential council will name a new government in a month, and a UN Security Council resolution will endorse it. U.S. intelligence agencies say the number of Islamic State fighters in Iraq and Syria has dropped by several thousands. However, in Libya, their number has roughly doubled to about 6,500 fighters. U.S. members of Congress and intelligence officials spoke of their growing concern about the militant organization's expansion in Libya. Islamic State leaders in Syria are telling new recruits to remain in Libya, where the group established a stronghold in the coastal city of Sirte. Intelligence officials say the organization's immediate goal is to carve out a new caliphate in Libya. Martin Kobler, the head of the UN support mission in Libya, told the Security Council that the Islamic State expansion in Libya poses a regional threat in the African continent.
It's very important to limit the expansion of the Islamic State, because this adds to the difficult situation. They are expanding at this stage to the east, to the west, but also to the south. They have bridgeheads in the south, and in Niger and Chad in the south, the neighbors, there are terrorist organizations, and if they team up with them, it will be very difficult to redress.
The latest wave of terrorist attacks emanating from Libya forced Tunisia to seal the border. The U.S. hopes for defeating the Islamic State in Libya rest on persuading parliamentarians to end their divisions and create a unity government in Libya. But Jason Peck, an expert on Libya and the founder of EyeOnISIS.com, recommends an alternative approach to bypass the political stalemate in Libya. He says the U.S. can facilitate a coalition of Libyan militias.
In Libya, there are many such forces who oppose ISIS. These forces tend not to work well together, but they all oppose ISIS, and a coalition of convenience can be made, and the Libyan nation can be rebuilt by bringing together these main fighting forces to work together against ISIS.
Peck argues that airstrikes alone are not likely to defeat ISIS. He says a coalition of Libyan militia forces can be the ground troops needed to mop up and conquer territories held by ISIS. Peck says such a coalition would need training and weapons before it could launch an attack to retake Sirte, aided by Western air power. Peck says the U.S. and Western powers should build up on the momentum of the latest gains against militant groups in Libya.
The cleansing of Benghazi and Ajdabiya of jihadist cells, both ISIS and Ansar Sharia, is a breakthrough. And the momentum of these gains need to be carried forward and hopefully lead to new militia coalitions that could launch an attack on Sirte.
But Michael O'Hanlon, a military expert at the Brookings Institution, says Islamic State is already entrenched in Libya. He says it's too strong for any of the local actors nearby to face by themselves.
Realistically, I think we'll have to start more modestly by trying to help certain groups that we believe we can work with to get stronger in certain parts of the country. But I think the beginning process has to be working with certain groups that can then pressure ISIS on the ground while we consider pressuring ISIS from the air.
But the Libyan ambassador to the UN, Ibrahim al-Dabashi, says such move could complicate the Libyan situation. Al-Dabashi says it should be remembered that these militias withdrew from Sirte as soon as they clashed with ISIS fighters. James Clapper, the director of national intelligence, told a congressional committee lately, "We would like nothing better than to have a government in place in Libya whom we could work with and from whom we would gain consent for engaging militarily in Libya." Mohammed Al-Chinawi, VOA News, Washington.
Malawi, farmers around the capital are using human urine on their crops instead of costly imported chemical fertilizers. It's the result of an innovative local initiative that is transforming the lives of both the farmers and city residents. Lamek Masina reports from Lilongwe, Malawi.
There is new business in the area 25A neighborhood these days, selling human urine for use as a crop fertilizer. Every day, people carry buckets of the stuff to the market. 75-year-old Modesta Kamoto says she uses the money to pay for school fees and buy food, soap, and school uniform for her 10 orphaned grandchildren. She collects the urine every morning from plastic containers her family members use as urinals, and she sells it to Urine for Worth Project. Urine has been nature's fertilizer for millennia, though that's not a well-known fact nowadays in the age of chemical fertilizers. Malawian agriculturist Goodfellow Peely started Urine for Worth as a small family initiative 9 years ago. It has grown into a thriving business. The project was one of six finalists for the HIVO's Social Innovation Award in Amsterdam in 2014.
We buy 20-liter container at 1,000 Malawi kwacha, and 5-liter container we buy at 300 Malawi kwacha. When we process that into fertilizer, we sell the same to farmers. 20 liters we sell 3,000 kwacha. The 5 liters we sell 1,000 kwacha.
He can buy up to 200 liters per day. Peely ages the urine in airtight containers for 7 days. The process kills germs and the smell, and it makes the liquid rich in nitrogen. He sometimes adds lemongrass to help with odor, but says no additives are actually needed. Farmers say the fertilizer is cheaper and more environmentally friendly than chemicals. Urine for Worth has now erected a urine harvesting plant at the main market in Area 25A with funding from two environmental NGOs. People are encouraged to relieve themselves there in special urinals. The project also has women selling composite manure they make mixing the urine with the animal waste. Ened Jadza is a widow and leads a group of 20 women. She says her worries are gone, and she's able to feed her family with what she earns. Despite their success, Peely says challenges abound.
The greatest challenge with this type of product, which is bionitrate fertilizer, is that many people don't like it. They think it's unhygienic to apply fertilizer made from human urine.
Seed companies and the Ministry of Agriculture have enlisted Urine for Worth to produce fertilizer for their demonstration fields, something Peely hopes will win over more farmers to the idea. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Lilongwe, Malawi.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to African News Tonight for the latest sports features and more coming up next right here on VOA. For the full hour of African News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss food and the rise of African cuisine with host Shaka Sali and his guests. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis? We've got it all on VOAAfrica.com.
VOAAfrica.com.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Dozens of Ethiopian university students protested last night against recent police crackdowns in Addis Ababa. And in Nigeria, labor unions are protesting government plans to restructure the state-run oil industry. Coming up, we'll have music from the DRC. And later, hundreds of South Sudanese refugees in Uganda are turning to agriculture as a means to earn income. I'm Kim Lewis with Yeheyas Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. And of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with the mighty, mighty Douglas Mpuga sitting in this week for Sonny Young. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Kim.
What's on tap today?
Well, Kim, we shall kick off in South Africa with athletics.
Okay.
Thank you very much. In athletics, South Africa's Akani Simbine broke his old national 100 meters record with a 9.96 clocking at the first ASA Night Series meeting in Pretoria on Tuesday. Simbine, whose previous personal best of 9.97 was set when winning the 100-meter title at last year's World University Games, had a solid start and was level with Emily Erasmus for much of the first half of the race. But once the 22-year-old hit top speed, he eased away from the rest of the field to win by about 3 meters. Simbine clocked 10.02 in the semifinals of the IAAF World Championships Beijing 2015 to miss a place in the final by just 0.03. Only one man, Frank Fredericks, has ever run faster at this stage of the season. The multiple world and Olympic medalist clocked 9.94 in Sydney in February 1999. Although Pretoria lies at altitude and so is conducive to fast times, Simbine bettered his 2015 early season marks from the same venue on numerous occasions later that year at sea level and with minimal wind. In the women's 100 meters in Pretoria, Karina Horn won in 11.23 from Alyssa Conley's personal best of 11.29, both Olympic qualifying marks. Conley then went on to win with the 200 meters in 23.48. Thapelo Fora, who will compete in the 4x400 meters at next week's IAAF World Indoor Championships, Portland 2016, won the 400 meters in 45.64, while Orazio Cremona won the short put with 20.05 meters.
You ask for it and we answer it. The Sunny Side of Sports is expanding our showtime on VOA Africa.
Well, let's go to Johannesburg, South Africa, and join Daybreak Africa's Mark Ouma, who begins his reporting with wrestling.
Hosts Egypt bagged 9 gold, 6 silver and 7 bronze medals to top the overall medal table at the Africa Wrestling Championships, which ended in Alexandria on Monday. Tunisia is second ahead of Nigeria. Algeria is fourth, followed by Senegal, Cameroon, Guinea-Bissau, South Africa, Morocco, Namibia and Chad. Tunisia prevailed in the men's freestyle wrestling, with Egypt second ahead of Nigeria, while Nigeria carried the day in the women's freestyle wrestling, with Tunisia second ahead of Egypt. Egypt dominated the Greco-Roman event. Algeria were runners-up and Morocco placed third. Meanwhile, the East Africa Secondary School Sports Association Games President Justus Mugisha confirmed to the media in Kampala, Uganda on Monday that this year's regional sports event will be staged in Eldoret in Western Kenya. The week-long event, which features teams from Burundi, Rwanda, South Sudan, Tanzania, Uganda, Zanzibar and hosts Kenya, will start on the 26th of August. Turning to football, disgraced former FIFA Vice President Michel Platini has filed an appeal with the Court of Arbitration for Sports against FIFA's 6-year ban from all football activities, the Court of Arbitration for Sports revealed in Lausanne, Switzerland. According to FIFA's Ethics Committee and FIFA's Appeals Committee, Platini and former FIFA President Sepp Blatter attracted the sanction following a breach of the FIFA Code of Ethics. Finally, hosts Togo pipped Ghana by a solitary goal in a friendly match played in Lome over the weekend. Both sides fielded teams composed of home-based players. Both teams are preparing for the Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers later this month.
Thanks, Mark Ouma. That was Mark Ouma reporting from Johannesburg, South Africa.
The Voice of America. VOA. Hello, Africa. Dr. Larry Zamoja here, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 88.9 Brilla FM. Keep getting sporty sunshine with Sunny Young. We all do at Sports Radio 88.9 Brilla FM, broadcasting out of the cities of Lagos, Abuja, Kaduna, and Onitsha in Nigeria, as well as the World Wide Web on www.brillafm.net. I tell you this, it's always a thrill, yes, a thrill, to remain on the sunny side on Brilla with Sunny. Keep listening, Africa.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of life.
Voice of America, VOA, Washington.
Sports? Hear about it first, right here on the Sunny Side of Sports.
In African football, the CAF Confederation Cup, the second club football competition in the continent behind the CAF Champions League, resumes this weekend. Now we turn to our football guru, David Legg, in Johannesburg, South Africa, for an update of this competition. But first, David, the schedule of matches this year has been condensed. What do you think there is the reason for that?
I think it's just it's a situation that CAF have to, you know, condense the fixtures, Douglas, because they've got two rounds of the African Cup of Nations coming up at the end of the month. And I know you're going to be very interested in that because you've got the top two sides in each group as far as the seeding goes clashing against each other. In your case, I know you'll be watching Uganda very carefully. They're going to come up against Burkina Faso, matches in both Ouagadougou and in Kampala. So that is the reason. It seems to work quite well, Douglas. I was very concerned at first when they had fixtures on successive weekends because you know and I know that sometimes you can have logistical problems in Africa moving around. It's not quite as easy as some of the other continents. You can't just hop from point A to point B.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you have to go a rather roundabout way. I mean, it's always fascinated me that when South African team Orlando Pirates last year were competing in the CAF Confederation Cup and doing very well, when they played in North Africa, they didn't just go up the east coast of Africa, as I think most of us would have assumed. What they did is they flew right across into Dubai, in the heart of the Middle East, and then went from Dubai to Tunis or to Cairo or wherever. So an illustration there of the challenges of travel. But it must be said in favor of the clubs and in favor of CAF as well. Good organization because everything seems to work out okay.
David, now the CAF Confederation Cup resumes this weekend. What updates do you have?
Right. We move now, Douglas, to the second-tier competition, which is the CAF Confederation Cup. And an identical problem, this time for Al Ittihad of Libya. They couldn't travel to Niger last week because of the strike at Niamey Airport. So they were a bit late in playing their return match against Sonadep. And the Libyans got quite a fright. They were leading 4-1 from the first leg, and they scored again after just 3 minutes of the return match. So now they were 1-0 ahead on the day and 5-1 ahead on aggregate. But Sonadep came back with a bang in the closing stages, scored three goals to win the match 3-1. But unfortunately for the Nigerians, they went out 5-4 on aggregate. Now, Douglas, let's look at the draw for the last 32 stage of the CAF Confederation Cup. It's V-Club Makanda of Congo-Brazzaville against Police of Rwanda, Esperanca Sagrada of Angola against Desportivo Maputo of Mozambique, Maludia Oran of Algeria against Gag Noah of Ivory Coast, Kwakab Marrakesh of Morocco against Barak Young Controllers 2 of Liberia. I love the name of that club. Bits of South Africa against Azam of Tanzania, Renaissance of Chad against Esperance of Tunisia, Harare City of Zimbabwe against Zanaco of Zambia, Stade Gabessien of Tunisia against Kaloum of Guinea, Nasarawa United of Nigeria against CS Constantine of Algeria, Al Makawash of Egypt against Don Bosco of DR Congo, Lupopo of DR Congo against Alassi Shendi of Sudan, Itihad of Libya against Mediama of Ghana, Loom of Cameroon against Fuzz of Morocco, Villa of Uganda against JKU of Zanzibar, Atletico Olympic of Burundi against Munana of Gabon, and last but certainly not least, a really spicy one here, Africa Sports of Ivory Coast against ENPPI of Egypt. Again, Douglas, the first legs, March 11, 12, 13. Return matches, March 18, 19, and 20. Now, we've got some very sharp listeners on the Voice of America, and they will realize that last week on the show, I said Loom of Cameroon had been eliminated. They did, in fact, lose a penalty shootout against Deportivo Mongomo of Equatorial Guinea. So what's happened since, Douglas, is it has been discovered that Mongomo fielded an ineligible player. So they were disqualified, and UMS Loom of Cameroon are back in the competition. And they will, interestingly, play the only former champions of the CAF Confederation Cup in this field, and that is FUS Rabat of Morocco.
That was our football guru, David Legg, reporting from South Africa.
You want to listen to the latest African music? Just tune in to the African Beat on the Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays at exactly 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
African Beat. We love it!
I feel good!
But right now, you're listening to the sunny side of sports, so check it out.
Now wait till they be so... Well, the former World Anti-Doping Agency president, Dick Pound, has described as reckless beyond description Maria Sharapova's failed drug tests. Sharapova, who is 28, revealed on Monday that she tested positive for the banned substance Melodinium in January. A number of sponsors have already distanced themselves from the Russian. Pound is reported saying he cannot understand how Sharapova found herself in this situation, given the high stakes involved, both professionally and financially. Sharapova has been the highest-earning female athlete in the world in each of the past 11 years, according to the Forbes list. However, sportswear giant Nike has suspended its relationship with the five-time Grand Slammer, while watch manufacturer Tag Heuer has cut its ties. German carmaker Porsche said it was postponing planned activities with Sharapova until the situation became clearer. And now, for what's trending on social media, we turn to Andrew Pochettino. Sharapova should be trending on the media.
Oh, it absolutely. Maria Sharapova is trending. On the one hand, you have a lot of people on social media wondering about this substance that she tested positive for. Is it a performance-enhancing drug? People, mm-hmm. Some people are saying you're only supposed to take this drug supposedly for 4 to 6 weeks. She was taking it for 6 to 10 years. People were wondering, you know, that seems strange. Other people saying, no, it's only recently been added to this list of banned drugs, so she was taking it legally. But there's a lot of debate on what punishments she might see mm-hmm. from the tennis officials. One punishment she's already seeing, and apropos of your point that she's the highest-paid female athlete for the past 11 years, she's losing a lot of endorsements. That's why, in fact, she's been the highest paid female athlete. Mm-hmm. I heard something earlier today that she's only made in tournaments several million dollars and about $30 million in endorsements. So she's losing a lot of those endorsements, as social media is noting, things like Nike, Porsche, some watch companies, foods, mm-hmm. other things that are backing away from her. Mm-hmm. And one thing I did find interesting, amidst all this debate, you have a lot of people saying, oh, of course, she was doping, she should be punished. There were two hashtags on Twitter that I saw trending, hashtag I stand with Maria and hashtag whole world with Sharapova. So she does have her fans still out
there. She has a very big fan base.
She has a huge fan base mm-hmm. around the world, and so a lot of those fans are coming to her defense. Interestingly, also Serena Williams, one of her biggest rivals. No love lost between those two on the tennis court. She's mm-hmm. actually come out and offered some kind words to Maria Sharapova, saying she was shocked, but saying that she thought it was very courageous for Sharapova to come out and make this announcement.
I see. So, Andrew, what else is trending?
Well, we have that Sharapova story, lots of people talking about that, and also a story that Facebook may be trying to get into the sports game with their live streaming. So Facebook has introduced live streaming now where you can, like Periscope on Twitter, you can stream live to your Facebook, and many people are embracing this, using this. Well, Facebook says they want to live stream National Football League games, particularly on Thursday nights. Used to be Sunday was the day when you would watch football here in the U.S., and it's expanded now. There's a Monday night football game, and now there's Thursday night football. Well, Facebook wants to jump on that Thursday night football, stream that live on Facebook. So rather than watching football on TV, you might be watching it on Facebook on your laptop or even your smartphone.
I would think that's a very smart move on the part of Facebook.
Absolutely. It's the one that they're going to get a lot of audience for if they succeed at this. It might be a very expensive proposition for them to try to buy the rights to those Thursday evening games. Of course, anytime you have rights in the National Football League to air games, it can be a multi-billion dollar with a B affair. So it may cost a lot of money for Facebook, but it may pay out for them in the end as they get more users on to watch these games and maybe sell some more ads and make some more money themselves.
I see. Well, thanks a lot, Andrew. Andrew will be back again on Friday with more sports topics that are trending on social media. And that's it for this edition of the Sunnyside of Sports. I'm Douglas Impuga. Now back to you, Kim.
Thank you, Douglas. And listen to the Sunnyside of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Douglas will have an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunnyside of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, hundreds of South Sudanese refugees in Uganda turning to agriculture as a means to earn income. But first, some music. Here is Fally Ipupa from the DRC with Ndoki.
Oh, Pacifique Kilo Bravo, Patrick Bacala.
Docteur Tikoko sa mama kena kobika ye.
Oye bibien na za mourant d'ici là.
Ordonnance aux premiers la yes, regardons ya bouti na koufie ye. Pharmacie ya kozongi sa mbongote. Mbongwe kokyo tunga bangwa tana soukalie.
Ya matanga na bolie ba kotide.
Lokuma famina na ha. Mama ye. Pasteur Tikoko sa famille kena kobika ye. Mon nazana yango e utina bade monte anani ne utina sans sa chérie poitique ngai il suffit bobena nana ya wae une minute zalie belle na kobika na kobina pour vous prouver que zaie botika kwa kize bade mwangani ye
On lui a souhaité le mal, mais Dieu l'a transformé en très bien. Danis Sumbu, l'homme qui a sauté les
bouts. DRC's Fally Poupa with Ndoki.
Well, hundreds of South Sudanese refugees in Uganda have turned to agriculture as a means to earn income. Many South Sudanese sought refuge in northern Uganda after fighting broke out in late 2013. Bonifacio Taban visited the Babwaye refugee settlement camp and files from Kampala.
James Makirter walked 20 minutes every day to go and clear to work on his farm. Five of Makir's sons are helping him expand his farm. Although the grassy bush is taller than his boys, the hard work has not deterred Makir and his son from getting the job done. Speaking in Nuer, Makir said he decided to start farming because he saw it as the only way to earn a livelihood and overcome the financial challenge he faced as a refugee in the Biala resettlement camp.
Uganda, Sudan,
when I arrived here in Uganda because of conflict in South Sudan, I saw that this land has a lot of opportunities and I have decided to start farming. And I know doing this job will strengthen me. Although the UNHCR is supporting me, I have to do more in order to support my family.
Makir said he had best 50 kilogram bags of maize last year. He said he sold 20 bags of maize and earned enough money to buy a school uniform for his children. He said he hoped to harvest even more maize this year. Makir encouraged other South Sudanese refugees at the settlement camp to try farming.
Because when you produce more food, you will not have any problem. When you store grain, it is not like any other business. But if you sell clothes to earn money, you may still suffer when there is a shortage of food.
Another refugee who turned to agriculture to earn a living is 35-year-old Mary Nyaber Koryom. A mother of 10, Koryom said he never expected to become a farmer until he arrived at the Biala refugee settlement. Now Nyaber Koryom said he is able to feed her 10 children, pay their tuition fees, and buy them a school uniform.
We have lack of tractors and buying pesticide because it's very expensive. We lack support to practice agriculture. We do this work for sake of our own surviving in this camp.
In this settlement camp, like many others across the country, the Ugandan government and the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees have allocated land to refugees so they can live on subsistence farming. For VOA News, I'm Bonifacio Taban, reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanov, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Society of Professional Journalists, in its voluntary code of ethics, says that journalists should seek the truth and report it, minimize harm, act independently, and be accountable. Distorting and mischaracterizing statements of officials so as to produce an inflammatory article seemingly aimed at provoking violence is not in keeping with professional journalism. In a polemic entitled Chibitoke, an image that has ended the illusion of the concept of Sindhu Mujua, or I am not a slave, that was published by www.burundi-24.com on February 21st, the publication mischaracterizes statements and actions by U.S. officials, including the President of the United States, Barack Obama. Neither the tone of the article nor the significant misleading and inflammatory statements can be characterized as meeting the internationally generally recognized standards of free, independent, and professional media services. The United States Embassy in Burundi, in an open letter published on its website, strongly condemned the intent apparent in the article to provoke anti-Rwandan sentiments, possibly including violence. In this regard, the embassy noted that the president of Burundi, Pierre Nkurunziza, had himself condemned hate speech or violent language on February 20th in Chibitoke. The embassy further noted, moreover, that unlike the author or authors of the article, President Nkurunziza affirmed in Chibitoke that all Burundians, including those who have fled the country, must participate in inclusive political dialogue regarding the path to peace for Burundi. The assertion in the article that civil society triggered the insurgency suggests that www.burundi-24.com believes that all elements of civil society that do not share its view should be excluded from the dialogue, despite President Nkurunziza's call for inclusive dialogue. In its open letter, the U.S. Embassy emphasized that the U.S. Ambassador to Burundi, Her Excellency Don LeBerry, and the U.S. Special Envoy, Mr. Thomas Pariello, went to Chibitoke on February 20th to express the U.S. government's continued solidarity with all Burundians, regardless of political orientation, who seek the chance to educate and raise their children in a secure, pluralist Burundi. A free press is essential to building a free and stable civil society. Journalists play an invaluable role when they follow the canons of their profession and provide the public with reporting that is fair and accurate and commentary that is responsible.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss food and the rise of African cuisine with host Shaka Sali and his guests. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa, next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.